Our last speaker is Arnold Sikkema at Trinity Western University, who's going to be speaking to us about modern physics and the human brains.
Okay, all right, thank you. And thanks for squeezing me in, actually, in a late abstract submission that I gave. So I'm grateful to be here and learning about the human person from many different perspectives. So the outline of my talk is as follows. I'm planning to talk about how composition, things we're made of, is more than physical. I'm actually going to skip something referenced in the abstract because I think that it was quite covered quite well on with our Friday evening plenary, but maybe there will be some questions about that. I will speak also about coherence as opposed to top-down or bottom-up in terms of causation. And then I'll end by some remarks about indeterminism. So I'm going to start with reference to the story. C.S. Lewis, I guess his name came up so many times during this conference and also by me. So in the Narnia Chronicles, we have the voyage of the Dawn Treader. In that story, there's a conversation near the end of the book between Caspian and Eustace, along with Raimondu. And so I'm just going to read a part of that conversation. As they landed on the boat that they were traveling along, stopped at an island, many islands, but on this particular island, they were conversing with someone named Raimondu. And so Caspian asks, are we near the world's end now, sir? Have you any knowledge of the seas and lands further east than this? I saw them long ago, said the old man, but it was from a great height. I cannot tell you such things as sailors need to know. Do you mean you were flying in the air? Eustace blurted out. I was a long way above the air, my son, replied the old man. I am Raimondu. But I see that you stare at one another and have not heard this name. And no wonder, for the days when I was a star had ceased long before any of you knew this world, and all the constellations have changed. Golly, said Edmund under his breath. He's a retired star. And then Eustace says, in our world, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. And Raimondu's response is, even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. And so I want to think about that in context of what is existence and what are human persons and also what are electrons. So what are stars? Eustace said stars are balls of hot flaming gas. Now, leaving aside the fact that we know they're not actually balls of flaming hot gas, but there's a nuclear furnace going on up there. So we put that in quotation marks. What are stars? Stars are also navigation aids. They are objects of beauty and wonder. They're sources of all the atoms that we have beyond helium. Hydrogen and helium didn't require stars to make, but every other element that we have was made in stars. They are also centers of planetary systems. So we are learning nowadays that most stars probably have planetary systems going around them. They are sources of radiant energy for planets. They are parts of galaxies. So what is a star? Well, all of these kinds of things are what stars are. So Raimondu told Eustace, even in your world, my son, that's not what a star is, but only what it is made of. So what are humans made of? Well, humans are made of protons and neutrons and electrons, of atoms. And you can go down below protons and neutrons to get into quarks, up and down quarks, etc. We're made of molecules. We're made of cells and tissues and organs and systems.
And macaroni and cheese.
And apparently Harry eats macaroni and cheese. You are what you eat, I suppose, is what you're getting at. So the first line there is talking about physical composition. What are we physically composed of? Well, atoms. What are we chemically composed of? We're composed chemically of molecules, mostly organic molecules. Right? That's why Carl bought the letter C for that periodic table in the fundraiser. And biologically, we are made of cells and tissues and organs and systems. Now, sometimes people would refer to all of this as if this is physical composition. So physical composition includes physical and chemical and biological. I'd like to separate those mostly. But even this physical composition is not comprehensive. We're made of more things than those. And so I want to refer to a poet named Muriel Rukeyser, and in her poem, The Speed of Darkness, which I don't recommend, it's not a great poem, but there's a line in the poem, I'm sure I'll go and read it now, and it's kind of a shocking poem, but there's a line in there that's really striking, and she says, the universe is made of stories, not of atoms. Now, I actually disagree with her. The universe is made of stories and also of atoms. But the point here that she's drawing out is that we are, that the universe is made of stories. So what are we made of? Well, we are made of atoms, etc. The physical things that I mentioned there earlier, the chemical and the biological. But we're also made of stories. We're made of our relationships with others. We're made of our past experiences. We're made of our future hopes. We're made of our dreams and desires and our fears and beliefs and our joys and concerns. Those are things that make us up, that compose us, from which we are built and from which we, upon which we have our being. So it is as true that we are made of these things as it is true that we are made of atoms and molecules. My point here is that we ought not to equate the concept of composition with only physical composition. So if we look at atoms, that's talking about our physical, chemical, biological composition. We're talking about stories. We're thinking about our literary composition. We're also thinking about our social composition when we discuss our relationships with others. When we say that we're made of our past experiences and future hopes, we're talking about a temporal composition. When we're talking about our dreams and desires, fears and beliefs, joys and concerns, we're talking about our psychological composition, etc. So we don't only have a physical composition, we have a composition. We're composed of all of the kinds of things at many different levels. So this is the point that I want to make, that we transcend. So we just should not equate the concept of composition with only physical composition. We should remember the other aspects of our composition, of our ontology, of our being. We transcend the physical. We're more than our physical, chemical, and biological origins and structure. So now I'm going to talk about electrons, and I'm going to suggest that electrons are people too.
That's right.
Not quite, but I do want to point out that electrons, like people, are composed of their relationships. And so here's where the modern physics comes in. I want to describe how it is that electrons have a similar composition with people in that they are made of their relationships. And so to get at that, I'm going to draw upon the work of Richard Feynman in his use of Feynman diagrams. I mean, he didn't come up with the name Feynman diagrams, but everybody called them Feynman diagrams. And the first Feynman diagram appears here in the literature in 1949, where it shows an interaction between electrons as being mediated by bosons. And so you see the idea here is you have to read this as a space-time diagram. So you think of space as going this way and time as going this way. So here are two electrons. At an early time, they're some distance apart, and they are coming closer together. This electron is coming to the left. This one is going to the right. As time goes along, there's an interaction. So how does the interaction occur? It occurs by, in this case, this electron coming to the left emits a photon, which is shown by the wavy line, and then this electron over here absorbs that photon, and they both change their course. So how did the electrons feel each other? They feel each other through mediating bosons. So this is a fundamental nature of particles, that they feel each other through intermediate bosons. So they're virtual photons. And so the way that electrons feel each other is that they don't directly feel each other, they feel each other through photons. Now, how does that get to thinking of electrons like people? Well, I'll get to that right here. So here is what we can think of when one electron simply exists. So the question is, what is an electron? Well, you might think an electron is like a little particle sitting there ready to interact with other things when necessary. So this is what's showing was as an electron just goes from one side of the screen to the other side of the screen. So as an electron isolated from anything else, as it exists, it is actually doing everything. So here's one of the things that the electron is doing. It is coming along and then setting off a photon and changing its path. This photon over here creates an electron-positron pair. A positron is an electron going backwards in space, backwards in time. And then these two particles, the electron and the positron, interact by way of a photon, etc. So this is a diagram which is showing that when you have an electron going from one place to another, it is not just going from one place to another on its own, it's actually continuously absorbing and emitting and reabsorbing photons, and those photons are also carrying on and interacting with other virtual electrons and positrons. And this is one of the things that the electron is doing. Now, it turns out that the electron doesn't just go from here to there and choose one of the options. In fact, you can assign this job to probably a teenager and say, draw all of the possible things that could be here that begin with a line and end with a line, and where every time that there's that three lines connect, there has to be two straight lines with arrows and one wavy line. So, and the lines are allowed to like turn a little bit too. So, how many do you think, how many different ways you could come up with? Are there other ways that you could make those work? Well, it turns out you can get an infinite number of them, and you can see that pretty clearly, because if you just take this line right here and replace it with the whole diagram, then that's another diagram. So anytime you have a line somewhere, you could replace it by the whole thing. I know I already started with a complicated thing, but you could really start with a simpler thing as well. So this is actually called the sum over histories, and it's a sum because it's actually an integration. So each drawing represents a mathematical term called an integration. So we're actually doing an integral, multiplying various factors together, propagation factors and vertex factors, and we're doing integrations, and we're doing this to determine what's called the propagator of the electron. How does the electron propagate? It propagates by doing all of the possible things that it could be doing with respect to all of the other kinds of particles that exist in the universe, even if the electron is totally isolated from all of those other particles. So here we have only included the photon-electron interactions. Photons also interact with other things, and so this diagram is only showing part of it. So there could be the production of a muon, an anti-muon pair right here as well. And since though they exist, they are part of the expression. If we miss anything, we will get the answer wrong. We have to actually include every possible thing that the electron could be doing in order to get this right. So we have to add up every single thing that it could be doing to tell us what it actually is doing in its existence. So an electron just sitting there is the sum of all the possible things that it could do. So we call that the sum over histories. So that the idea is that the electron does everything that it could do. So what I'm pointing out here is that this here is an interaction vertex. So this is an interaction between the electron and the photon. And what we're seeing is that the electron is related to the photon, and the way that the electron exists is its actual existence builds into it the relationships that it has. So all of the relationships that the electron has are part of what the being of the electron is. So with the claim, the idea here is that the electron is fundamentally relational. So we said a moment ago that we are made of our relationships as humans. Well, so are electrons. Electrons are also made of their relationships. So now I'm going to just address a couple other things relevant to modern physics and how that connects to the human person. when we think about interactions, we recognize that that is what the physical aspect is about. So physical interactions assume, so the very nature of physics is that it discusses how things interact with one another. And when we are now thinking about mental aspects, so humans, I guess it's important for humans that we have a mental aspect that includes our feelings, our emotions, our ability to make distinctions. And so if we think about what happens when a human acts, what happens when I raise my hand? So the question is that action of me raising my hand, is that bottom up? In which case the electrons in my body, for example, electrons, etc., when they're moving about and then they give me the sense of having directed this action. So that's bottom up. Or maybe it's top down, that the electrons begin to move around because a mental function or some spiritual entity is making those electrons move around and governing them in some sense. And I'm suggesting that both of these two are incorrect, and that what's really going on is that there's coherence. So neither is it that my mind governs the electrons, or that the electrons sort of make my mind up, but that I raise my hand. I, the human person, raises my hand. All of the aspects that I have, the physical aspects, the mental aspects, etc., they cohere with one another. And then the last topic I want to speak about is determinism and indeterminism. This was talked about already by Erik Carlson, but I have a slightly different tack, I think, on some of this. So the general idea of determinism is that the future of the world is fully determined by the present of the world. So if we know everything about the world now, that settles what the future will be. So that's determinism. And physical determinism was really the result of assuming that the world was explained according to Newton. And Laplace was really the one who identified Newtonian determinism as what would have to be philosophically the case. So the future is locked in by the present. That's determinism. Indeterminism simply says that determinism is false. And I think the physical example of indeterminism is quantum events. So quantum events occur without there being the necessity of that particular event occurring from the present state of the universe. And in addition to that, we also have chaotic events. So systems that are nonlinear, like the atmosphere, have in them things that are occurring that depend intrinsically, even in their qualitative behavior, on the entire universe's behavior and presence. So the atmosphere, for example, has weather forecasting limited to 10 days at the most. It's impossible. It's absolutely theoretically impossible to predict the weather to any detail beyond 10 days because of the fact that the atmosphere is a nonlinear system and it exhibits chaos. So I'm going to suggest that part of being human is that we have a will and that we have choice and we have agency, and these things are real. So we as humans experience real will and choice and agency, and these things are indeterministic. We don't have the experience that we are simply going through the motions, but we experience that we have true choice, true will, a real agency. If there was determinism, that is, if the future of ourselves is totally locked in, then our choices are only apparent. Our will is only apparent, and our agency is only apparent. But I'm suggesting that since God is the creator of our real world, then agency, every aspect of being human, is also real. Now, I would suggest that this indeterminism that we see at the quantum level and the chaotic level, that coheres with this general indeterminism that we experience also as humans. We also have the fact that that the quantum indeterminism might be at the right kind of scale. Our human bodies are macroscopic. Quantum events are microscopic, but in the middle of that, we have the biochemical reactions, which involve things like our nerves, which are possibly at the sort of scale where quantum events might matter in some way. So there's caveats here. So a few sort of qualifiers. There are some interpretations of quantum physics that say that quantum physics and quantum events are in fact deterministic. The problem with that, as mentioned also by Eric Carlson on Friday night, is that we have to then give up locality, which is a tantamount to giving up causality. That is, there are going to be effects that are universal any given instant that we can't have any way, any sense of this one event causing a future event. Because even the concept of future and present and past reverse in according to the theory of special relativity. So that's a caveat, just suggesting that even though I've said I think quantum physics is indeterministic, I think really, if you want to give up locality and causality, you're welcome to think of the universe as actually being deterministic, and I don't want to go there. a caveat, the physical indeterminism of the world, chaos and quantum, does not negate the idea of divine determination or divine providence. So perhaps God governs the world, and I suggest that he actually does, but it's not that the world determines its own future. Maybe God determines the future of the world, and that is a possibility that I can't really comment on from the point of view of physics. Also, I think that the physical indeterminism isn't the same thing as our human indeterminism, because if it was, then all it's saying is that the randomness of the physical world is making our wills and choices and agency also random. And that doesn't also appear to be the case. It seems we are actually choosing things, not simply noticing, oh, what? So my left hand suddenly went up and now my right hand. But we are actually actively involved. And so I'm not suggesting that the fact that there's indeterminism at the chaotic and quantum levels, that is enough to solve the question of human agency in the world. So in summary, I'm suggesting that ontology is relational, both at the level of electrons and persons and really everything else. And that is an interesting, actually, resonance, I think, with the Trinity. The Trinity is relational. And so God is a relational being. He created the universe to be relational, and that relationality seems to be reflected even from electrons up to humans and then beyond as well. Human actions are coherent across all aspects, the physical, the mental, for example. Instead of simply being top-down or bottom-up in the way that causation occurs, and I think that's just because creatures, including humans, are integral and whole as beings. And also that the indeterminism of modern physics coheres with the indeterminism of... the indeterminism of modern physics coheres with the indeterminism that we need to have and that we do experience of having as a human person, and I think still some mysteries remain in how to resolve all of these questions. So with that, thank you for your attention. Yes, Kevin.
So you talk about how using physics as a human person, right, and you show about electrons. Alistair McGrath writes in his book about how if you because everything has carbon atoms, like dead atom organism, living organism. But what distinguishes them is that there's energy, like echoes. So I'm just curious in terms of modern physics, what do you think about like the energy?
Energy is important. I mean, sometimes people define physics to be the study of matter and energy, and every time that there's an interaction, there's conservation of momentum and energy. So here we go. In any of these diagrams, at each vertex, momentum is conserved and also energy. Are you asking like about the distinction between living and dead things? That living things have energy and dead things don't?
Well, I guess everything also has electrons too. I guess.
Yeah.
I guess McGrath just said there's energy component. Maybe it focuses more on energy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure what's a comment there. I mean, energy is an important concept in physics, and energy is important for every particle. Entropy and energy, take different forms in living beings versus beings that aren't living, but I'm not sure where to go further with that. And then there's a question in the middle there, and then Janet, probably.
Yeah, this is really fun talk. Thank you very much. I guess I'm just a little confused, and so sorry if this is a naive question, but given that in a lot of relativistic settings, the idea of causality kind of goes out the window when you lose the idea of simultaneity. Why are we concerned about non-locality kind of having issues for causality?
Yeah, no, that's not a stupid question or dumb or a simple question. It's an important one. So I didn't get to talk much about relativity, except I hinted on it a bit by saying that if you lose locality, then you also lose causality. And the reason for that is that the concept of past, present, and future is limited within light cones. So that is, if I want to have an effect on something else, I can only affect something that is within my light cone. So that is, I can't affect something earlier than a signal of light could get to it. So that if I want to affect something in New York City from here, I can't affect anything that's going to happen there, you know, in less than whatever, 2 milliseconds or however long it takes for light to get there from here. So, if I am able to affect something at this instant in New York City, then one can't say that that event occurred after my event, or in fact, it could have been that event happened before me, or I could have done the event here before that event. And so the order of causation is lost when we are having something like occur simultaneously. Maybe that helps in what I'm addressing here. And then there's Jan and then Efat, if that's okay.
Yeah. So when I think of relationality, I'm thinking in terms of humans made in the image of God, and that being an aspect. Another important aspect is the functional aspect, in terms of us having purpose, working together with God, caring for creation, etc. I wonder if you could make that analogy at the subatomic level as well.
So I guess I focused on just relationality, and I wouldn't say that the electron bears God's image in a direct sort of way, but in a sense, everything in creation is stamped by God. And so I think it is interesting, and it's an echo perhaps of God's Trinitarian relationality, that electrons also exhibit relationality. Everything also in the world has functionality, right? And so you're suggesting like human things that humans do, we do in order to image God, to represent God, and so forth. Things that electrons do, they don't have, you know, will and responsibility before God as do humans, but electrons do have functions. And everything in the world has some kind of function, and they do function, and, you know, they're needed. So we need electrons in order to have chemistry. We need chemistry in order to have biology. We need biology in order to have, you know, psychology, etc. But I'm not sure if I'm really getting at what you're asking, Janet.
Well, no, I'm just wondering if you do the same thing, but using, instead of relational, and you say functional.
Okay, so I guess you're saying, just as I described electrons and humans as being similar in the fact that they are relational, I could possibly also talk about electrons and humans in terms of functionality. Perhaps I could have done that. I hadn't really thought of that, but the point here was more in terms of ontology. And I guess functionality and ontology are maybe not close, as closely related as function as ontology and relationality, I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting, you know, to be is to have relations. And then if what follows from that might be functions. Perhaps. I mean, we can talk about that. And then Efat had a question as well, if it's okay.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yeah.
Ross Hastings wrote a book.
Yeah.
Echoes of Coherence. Yeah. He talks about this very thing.
Exactly. He talks about the general thing, and his later book, I mean, has referenced my idea of this quantum thing for electrons. And he's a great friend and colleague at Regent. So, yeah. Efat, did you have a comment or question?
Yes. This very much appeals to the general notion of interdisciplinarity in today's modern world. Because what you're writing here, you're writing a very important conclusion. Creatures are integral and whole. And the way it appeals to interdisciplinarity is that there's a need for connection and relation either between disciplines, and having that cross-disciplinarity and multidisciplinary notion, it should be based, it is not very much so in secular environment, but it should be based on that ontological, biblical coherence that's actually found in the Bible. So there's that foundational coherence that is found in scripture that lays the foundation to why those relationships should exist and why the individual should have that hybrid skill set and that and allow opportunities for relations to happen between various disciplines in today's world.
Well, thanks. And as was mentioned, if you went to a talk, well, I went to a talk by Remke Koistra from King's, and he said that he was able to think about these things partly because he's at a Christian liberal arts college. And I think the same is true for me. I wouldn't have had these kind of thoughts if I was just doing my physics research in a lab somewhere, not connected with other universities and so forth. Other disciplines, I mean.
Let's thank Arnold one more time.